Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now in Exile.
Today we have just the opposite in the city of Madison. We have political correctness run rampant. Patriotism, ladies and gentlemen, is not a dirty word. It is not one step from fascism or McCarthyism or all the other isms.
The Bush administration has compared the war on terrorism with the Cold War. Will the climate be the same? Today, an hour on the suppression of dissent in wartime. Madison, Wisconsin erupts over whether kids should have to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. We'll have a debate. And the new McCarthyism? The City University of New York denounces professors who criticize U.S. military retaliation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. What may be the most dangerous job in this time of anthrax? Being a postal worker. The New York Union of Postal Employees has just hired a law firm. And what about the janitors who work in the buildings of places like ABC, NBC, the New York Times, not to mention the Senate Hart office building, where apparently Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle has received a letter as well that has tested positive for anthrax. U.S. warplanes Monday launched their heaviest daylight strikes yet on Afghanistan, and War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned Taliban troops dug in north of Kabul that more bombs are on the way. A senior defense official says the Air Force sent the AC-130 turboprop gunship into combat, marking a new step in the bombing campaign. A UN advisor on food policy has criticized U.S. food drops over Afghanistan, saying they endanger civilian lives and put future humanitarian operations at risk. He also urged a halt to the bombing, saying airstrikes are making it almost impossible for international agencies to deliver large amounts of aid to Afghans. Airdrops are not only ineffective, he says, but also dangerous for residents of one of the world's most heavily mined countries. The UN worker said humanitarian action has been annexed by the anti-terrorist coalition, calling it a catastrophe for aid organizations worldwide. Thousands of people joined a Gaza funeral procession yesterday for a 19-year-old man killed in a pro-Osama bin Laden demonstration in what amounted to the biggest protest ever by Palestinians against their governing authority. He was one of three Palestinians who lost their lives in the protest after gunfire erupted. Families of the dead and human rights groups said Palestinian police had shot them and warned the Palestinian Authority to punish those responsible for the shootings or else face mass protest. And Canada unveiled a sweeping security bill yesterday that would widen wiretapping authority, allow police to make preventive arrests of people they think will engage in violent acts. The Canadian bill largely matches the so-called anti-terrorist legislation approved last week by the U.S. Congress. And Secretary of State General Colin Powell arrived in Pakistan yesterday for talks with President Pervez Musharraf amidst widespread protests by Pakistanis and a general strike called by Muslim leaders, which closed thousands of shops around the country. The two leaders agreed on the goal of overthrowing the Taliban, but Musharraf and Powell also said that any future Afghan government should include opposition as well as Taliban members. Powell also said a peaceful resolution of the Kashmir dispute is central to ending hostility between nuclear rivals India and Pakistan and urged the two to begin a dialogue. Powell spoke just hours after the countries fought a fierce gun battle across the disputed border in Kashmir, the first hostilities in 10 months. A senior Indian Army official said Indian forces shelled Pakistani military posts across the ceasefire line Monday in Kashmir, destroying 11 posts. We go now to India. Sputnik Colombi, Free Speech Radio News correspondent, is standing by. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Sputnik.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you again.
It's good to have you with us. I was just watching the television news, and they said that the reason that India has fired on Pakistan is because there is Powell in Pakistan with the Pakistani president, and that Powell and that India wants to make it clear that Kashmir and that India's claims will not be sacrificed in the relationship that Powell, that the U.S. has with Pakistan. What is your assessment of that?
Well, yes, I mean, that's what they've been saying ever since the bombings in New York and Washington, ever since the attacks in New York and Washington. And it is true to an extent that India has tried to gain mileage of it. It should be recalled that India went to the United States offering help, unconditional support, etc., even before it was asked to. And there were a lot of people who were missed here in the ruling elite that Musharraf and Pakistan was chosen, and that just a few months ago, President Bush didn't even know the name of the leader of Pakistan. Just a few months ago, you know, the United States was making noises about the lack of democracy and a speedy return to democracy after Musharraf had taken power in a military coup. And suddenly, Musharraf seemed to have become the blue-eyed boy, and there were some people who felt that, you know, Musharraf was playing his cards better than India. But then India has been also working overtime to try and get the United States onto its side, and having failed to declare to get Washington to declare Pakistan a terrorism sponsoring state, they're now taking comfort from the fact that the Jaish-e-Mohammed, this Pakistani-based terror group, which was responsible for the October 1st suicide attack in front of the Jammu and Kashmir State Assembly, has now been banned by the United States and is on its list of foreign terrorists. So there's a lot of, you know, I mean, Musharraf's Colin Powell's statements today come as no surprise. The thing is, and the irony is, that India has always been insisting that Kashmir is a bilateral issue. That's a law and order problem, and it's a bilateral issue to be debated and negotiated between India and Pakistan, and there's no rule for any outside mediation. Yet the moment the Jaish-e-Mohammed struck in the Kashmir State Assembly, the first thing that Prime Minister Vajpayee did was to send off a letter to Washington asking the U.S. to ban the Jaish-e-Mohammed. So in a way, they've ended up inviting the U.S. through the back door. But what the U.S. can do is another big question. I don't think it can do much.
What will the India's attack on Pakistan mean for Powell's visit to India next?
Well, you know, there have been lots of strident noises coming from the Indian right, especially. I mean, the main opposition Congress party has been, you know, significantly silent on a lot of these issues. The left parties have criticized the government for its position. And on the, from the right, they have been attacked. They've been called to attack Pakistani bases, to even the chief minister of Kashmir, who is a government appointee, said India should attack these terrorist bases and tackle terrorism on its own if the United States doesn't want to, you know, include Kashmiri terrorism in its global fight against terrorism. So, yes, one could speculate that they're trying to put pressure, but that's what Colin Powell is going to say tonight when he meets the Foreign Minister Jasmant Singh, ask them to hold off, and then promise, as yet we don't know what he's going to promise. But I think everybody here is walking a tightrope.
Well, Sputnik Columbia, I want to thank you for being with us. We look forward to talking to you in our second hour here on the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now in Exile.
All was dear ever when free men shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace. May the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us, our nation. Then conquer we must when our cause is just, and this be our motto: in God is our trust. And the Star-Spangled Banner.
Tiny Tim singing the Star Spangled Banner, as we do today, an hour on the new McCarthyism here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 1,000 people tried to squeeze into the Memorial High School auditorium in Madison, Wisconsin last night for a school board meeting, with dozens overflowing into the school's cafeteria, with 230 people registered to speak. The 5 p.m. meeting dragged on until 3 in the morning. At issue, patriotism, America, and the Pledge of Allegiance. The state of Wisconsin passed a law several weeks ago requiring every public classroom to recite the Pledge of Allegiance or hear the Star Spangled Banner every day while respecting the right of students not to participate. But as flags spring up everywhere and racist attacks sweep the country in the wake of September 11th, some parents objected to having their children recite the pledge, either for religious or political reasons. The school board tried to compromise by passing a law which ruled out the pledge and offered the Star Spangled Banner without lyrics every day instead. The backlash was tremendous. Right-wing radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh urged his listeners to barrage the Madison School Board with letters and emails. Within days, board members received some 20,000 calls, emails, and letters, many of them hostile. One person wrote, "If anyone's ashamed of saying the Pledge of Allegiance, our flag, or any other symbol of being an American citizen, get the hell out of the country." She wrote, "Pakistan, Afghanistan, and numerous other countries await you. Good riddance to you, too." Opponents of the resolution are organizing to recall some of the board members. A conservative state lawmaker suggested schools don't comply with the state law should be cut off from state funding. Last night, the board reversed the resolution. We go now to a piece by Madison resident John Hamilton.
Recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance or the singing of the Star Spangled Banner, in my opinion, will do nothing to enhance citizenship. Rather, for those who, for whatever reason, choose not to participate, this daily exercise creates discomfort and alienation, certainly not a situation conducive to education. For this reason, I oppose the recitation of the pledge or the Star Spangled Banner and support the board's decision.
First of all, I'd like to remind the youngsters here that don't want to stand up to say the pledge that when I was 19, just a few years older than they are, I served with the 3rd Marine Division as a combat Marine, 1969 and 1970. And I saw a lot of kids lose their lives for freedom, for this country, for America. And they gave you the right to either sit or stand. Wouldn't that make you want to stand?
This country, for over 200 years, has functioned as a democratic republic. Therefore, the elected officials and representatives have, by and large, followed the will of the majority and not the minority. Today, we have just the opposite in the city of Madison. We have political correctness run rampant. Patriotism, ladies and gentlemen, is not a dirty word. It is not one step from fascism or McCarthyism or all the other isms. It is not.
Some of us have a particular problem with the Pledge of Allegiance because of the two words, under God. 40 years ago, when we pledged in the schools here, I, without prodding from my parents, felt very uncomfortable saying those words. So I went to my mother and I said, you know, I don't want to say this. And she said, you don't have to say those two words. And it was later that I found out that although a Baptist minister wrote this pledge, he did not include those words. They were added during the McCarthy era by people afraid of godless communism. And to me, what they feel like is a religious test for citizenship.
Let me also say that I do not support a ban on the Pledge of Allegiance. Banning the Pledge of Allegiance is no better than banning books. However, I am not outraged, and I am outraged. I am not outraged because of your action. I am outraged by the vehement, virulent, and quite frankly, anti-American backlash that's being foisted on this city. It's not just saying a pledge or waving a flag. I have nothing against the pledge. But let's leave to totalitarian governments an insistence on what we have to do or what we have to say or even what we have to hear and when we have to hear it. Let's leave it to totalitarian governments to have litmus tests that force us to prove that we're patriots.
I am a taxpayer. I live in Madison, and I love God's America. It is his America. It isn't ours. I just want to say that I think your stand is offensive to the entire United States, and I come against it in the name of Jesus Christ. I believe the children need to hear and stand and pledge. I believe it's healthy.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
The sounds of a meeting last night of the school board of Madison, Wisconsin, with more than 200 people speaking about a resolution that was passed by the school board that the students would not have to say the Pledge of Allegiance or the Sing the Star-Spangled Banner, that ultimately was reversed. And we're joined on the telephone right now by two school board members. Bill Keyes is a member who first introduced the resolution limiting students' daily patriotic ritual to the national anthem without lyrics. He was the only member of the school board to uphold that decision early this morning. And Carol Carstensen, school board member who initially voted for the resolution but reversed her position this morning. Bill Keyes, let's start with you. You stood by your resolution. Why?
I stood by my resolution because I felt there was still no protection for those students or families or staff who felt compelled against their will, felt coerced to participate in these activities. We did not have any input into how this was going to be implemented or even the creation of the law in the beginning. And this very stressful time is especially important that we protect individual rights and freedoms. The majority does not need to be protected. The minority does.
Carol Carstensen, why did you change your position?
Well, I was there are a couple of things. First of all, my original vote was for the actual amendment, but I did not intend some of the ways it was interpreted. I did not intend to interfere with what teachers did in their classroom as part of their curriculum. In other words, I don't feel that board members should be dictating curriculum to teachers, and therefore, since I knew that some teachers said the pledge or had said the pledge prior to this new law, I did not intend to affect their practice. The other reason is that it, because of the volume of response, both locally and nationwide, it essentially closed down the district from doing anything but responding to receiving the communications. It also closed down the ability of the board to deal with other issues. And I felt that all of this was doing great harm to the things that we needed to deal with and ultimately to the education of our students. There is an issue of protection of rights, and that's one of those areas where we are going to have to be vigilant. We have a very strong anti-harassment policy. We have taken steps to make sure that our staff respond to the needs of kids. And Bill can talk very much about this. Last spring, we created a position for a staff position to deal with harassment issues around gay and lesbian issues. So I would see this in the same light.
Bill Keyes, where do you go from here with this resolution?
Well, the resolution was obviously killed, and we returned to the state of affairs as they are. And I certainly will work very hard to see that the current policy is followed carefully and would hope that everybody else watches it carefully also. And Carol is right. We do have a strong anti-harassment policy in the city. I just hope that it continues to be vigilant and the sensitivity is increased and intensified so that people know when it is happening, whether obvious or subtle, and we'll report it.
Carol Carstensen, it sounds like your decision was more to do with this, the overwhelming response and the level of inability to work, than how you specifically felt about the resolution.
Well, as I said, I started out from the perspective of I did not want to have it, to change what teachers are doing in terms of their curriculum. And then I was very, very concerned about the way in which this issue was driving everything else. And I think that there is always, well, I should back up. One of the things that I have worked very hard at is building relationships between the school district and the community. And I think we have been very successful in terms of a number of initiatives, and it seemed to me that that was somewhat at risk. I will say that, you know, absent the impact on the district, I would have clarified the motion to, I would have kept the motion but clarified it to let people know that the teachers had the academic freedom to deal with, to have or not have the pledge in their classroom, as long as they made sure that they provided a comfort zone for students to participate or not participate. But I decided after several days of this that we needed to go a little bit further. I don't think there's a good solution. I think that certainly what we heard last night and this morning was very strong feelings on all sides. And there wasn't a whole lot of ground for compromise in the way people were feeling.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Carol Carstensen and Bill Keyes, both school board members in Madison, Wisconsin. The decision has been reversed to support a resolution that ultimately just would have meant that the Star Spangled Banner would have been played, although the words not sung, and because of tremendous national number of calls and emails and letters that have come in and the response of the community last night, that decision has been reversed. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. We come back, we're going to go to New York City to a Board of Trustees meeting yesterday that also was very heated, and it involved the sanctioning of professors who speak out against war. Stay with us.
Standing next to me in this lonely crowd is a man who swears he's not to blame. Protection. They say every man must fall. So I swear I see my reflection, yeah, somewhere inside these walls. I see my life come shine.
Nina Simone and Miriam Makeba singing I Shall Be Released here on the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. A piece in Rupert Murdoch's tabloid, The New York Post, reads, "Let's get clear on one thing. Yes, the First Amendment protects the right of any American, even college professors, to say stupid things in public. But the First Amendment does not require college professors to speak stupidly in public. That is, while City College of New York has an absolute right to disgrace itself, as it did with Tuesday's brainless campus teach-in, a word born of the morally myopic anti-Vietnam War movement, we wonder why it happened." The article goes on to say, "The CCNY profs, after carefully studying the horrors of September 11th, place the blame on America. Just like always, a math professor blames American imperialism and capitalist ruling class of this country." Another phrase in the article, another praise for peace, not war, because our diplomacy is horrible. Well, the criticism didn't stop with the tabloid. Matthew Goldstein, chancellor of the City University of New York, publicly berated the professors in remarks he made at the Harvard Club. He said, "Let there be no doubt whatsoever. I have no sympathy for the voices of those who make lame excuses for the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon based on ideological or historical circumstances. Those who do so should take pause to remember the children left without parents, the wives and husbands who lost their dear ones in these heinous and reprehensible attacks." And the CUNY, that City University of New York Board of Trustees, is also getting into the act. Some trustees drafted a resolution condemning the professional staff union's un-American and seditious statements, but they instead decided to back the chancellor's statement, according to a spokesperson. The trustees will vote on the issue at their meeting next week. In preparation for the meeting, the trustees convened a public hearing yesterday. We're going to go to that hearing in a minute, but first we're joined by Bill Crane. He is a City College professor of psychology, and he's one of those who was lambasted by the New York Post for his desire for, quote, peace, not war. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. So how did it happen? What was this teach-in?
Well, the teach-in on October 2nd was an attempt to understand how we got where we are today. What are the roots of terrorism? And also what we can do to bring about a solution to the problem. And many of us were concerned about doing something other than what the U.S. always does, which is bomb the guys they don't like and expand the cycles of violence. We bomb, and then there's retaliations, and we bomb further, and we seem to be getting into an ever-expanding horror. And so I and others tried to propose alternatives to the Bush policy, and there was a wide range of opinion at the teach-in. At the end of the teach-in, the president of City College, the new president's wife, stood up and said, Sarah Williams stood up and said how moved she was at the thoughtful discussion. She was getting information that was not in the New York Times. She felt like all the politicians in the world were trying to outdo one another by being more patriotic than the next one. And we all came away feeling it was a really thought-provoking, balanced, excellent teach-in. So the next day, the New York Post blasted me and others as being un-American or blaming the U.S. for the policies.
And how did the trustees respond?
Then, Jeffrey Weisenfeld said if it was up to him, it would be sedition.
And Jeffrey Weisenfeld is
a trustee. Then the chancellor said what you read, which is he has no sympathy for those voices that would justify or make lame excuses for these acts at the World Trade Center. No one was trying to make excuses or justify the terrorism. We're trying to understand. He confuses excusing with understanding, and I would say it's the university's obligation to bring critical analysis to foreign policy. Even when it thinks it's wrong, it has to say so. This is the intellectual's obligation. Now, the chancellor's statement will have a chilling, it is having a chilling effect. When the Post article came out and the chancellor's statement came out, people were telling all of us, watch what you say. Why did you do this? Why did you bring shame on the college? Well, we can't let this go on. We have to fight back, and we will have a teach-in, another teach-in today, because we can't be intimidated by this. It's a matter of free speech, but it's also an obligation to criticize foreign policy when one feels that it's going to produce the loss of many, many more innocent lives, and when it's destructive. If we don't criticize things when we think they're wrong, things will just go on, And we might as, if you can't criticize without being called un-American or excusing terrorism, then we might as well live in an authoritarian state ourselves.
And so what happened? What did the Board of Trustees say they're going to do? Why was the meeting held yesterday?
Well, they let us testify. Well, they tried to, in some ways, discourage many people from testifying on a resolution that is not on the calendar. But about
and the resolution said?
There's two resolutions that have been floated. One was the Wiesenfeld resolution, which is pretty much using words like sedition and bringing shame, and they should leave the university.
And who is they?
Us, Walter Down, me.
You're the professors who spoke out.
Who spoke out, yes.
Both who were on the panel and who stood up in the audience.
And stood up and spoke in the audience. Some professors argued that we have to retaliate with in a military fashion, but there was a range of opinions. But those who spoke out and offered some analysis of how we got where we are and some criticism were accused of that. And then the chancellor added his words, so we went to argue that about our obligation to speak out.
And so yesterday, we're going to play right now several of the people who spoke, but they're speaking to a resolution that will be voted on next Tuesday?
We don't know what will come up. At the beginning of the meeting, Benno Schmidt, the acting chair, said that they would not be endorsing the chancellor's report. We don't know what will happen at the meeting. It's highly, the state is a fluctuating one.
But clearly the pressure is on.
The pressure is on.
And we're going to go now to the CUNY headquarters. That's the City University of New York, where the Board of Trustees met yesterday and had the public hearing. Among those who spoke were City College students as well as professors. We'll start with Joanne Ratano, professor of history at LaGuardia Community College.
Dr. Joanne Ratano, professor of history at LaGuardia Community College and chairperson of the University Faculty Senate Community College Caucus. Times of crisis are truly unnerving, and the insecurity they cause tempts us to violate our most basic values. That is what happened in 1940 when the Supreme Court ruled that all school children must recite the Pledge of Allegiance regardless of religious affiliation. Let us learn from history. The Gobitis case was brought to the court by Jehovah's Witnesses who believed that the pledge forced them to bow down to a graven image. The court, however, insisted that because the flag is a symbol of our national unity, saluting it was essential to the promotion of national cohesion. The lone dissenter pointed out that infringements of personal liberty have repeatedly been justified in the name of righteousness and the public good. Consequently, he said, compulsory expressions of loyalty should never override the constitutional protection of freedom of speech and religion. The Gobitis decision unleashed persecution against Jehovah's Witnesses and their children, who were ridiculed, beaten, expelled from school. In this context, the justices reversed themselves in 1943, even though war still raged. Ruling in the Barnett case, they acknowledged the symbolic importance of saluting the flag, but affirmed that censorship or suppression of opinion is only justified by the Constitution when the expression presents a clear and present danger to the state. As they explained, the very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy and to ensure that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in matters of opinion. More importantly, they asserted that the freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much. That would be a mere shadow of difference. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order. The current crisis touches the heart of all Americans. We are a nation in pain, beset by shock and confusion. These circumstances make the role of the university as a safe haven for inquiry more important than ever. To welcome controversy is not to excuse terrorism. Rather, it is to champion what the court called the sphere of intellect and spirit. If the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court had, as they said, no fear that freedom to be intellectually and spiritually diverse will disintegrate society, neither should we. Thank you.
That was Professor Joanne Ratano, professor of history. Another professor of history then stood up, Sandy Cooper, who was with the College of Staten Island.
Professor of history at the College of Staten Island, a graduate school, and a member of the executive committee of the Faculty Senate. I'd like to dedicate these remarks to the memory of Professor Michael Kahn, whom I believe would have signed his name to them were he still with us. 100 years ago at the relatively new Stanford University in California, Professor Edward Ross of economics lectured on the gold standard, and in his class he argued that it inhibited growth and it kept workers' wages down. His views contradicted that of the deceased founder of the university, and the widow, Mrs. Leland Stanford Jr., demanded he be fired. The president and the chairman of the department agreed. He was fired despite the fact that the American Economic Association viewed his work as cutting edge, so cutting edge, in fact, that it is now routine common sense. As a result of Ross's experience, a half dozen years later, something called the American Association of University Professors was created in the middle of World War I, committed to the idea that views, interpretations, opinions of professors in all disciplines had to be protected by everyone, including trustees and college presidents who disliked them. And by 1940, the AAUP position became its famous statement on academic freedom, a statement which most reputable institutions in this country support. In fact, the American Association, now known as the American Association of American Colleges and Universities, signed on. This statement has been periodically edited and upgraded and reviewed. Here is its most recent version. It might be useful to distribute a copy of this to the trustees, some of whom have asked me, what is academic freedom and what is the AAUP? In pertinent part, the statement reads, quote, teachers are entitled to full freedom in research and the publication of the results. B, teachers are entitled to freedom in the classroom discussing their subject. C, college and university teachers are citizens, members of a learned profession, officers of an educational institution. When they speak or write as citizens, they should be free from institutional censorship or discipline. The statement has undergone refinement. It was upheld in 67 in the Supreme Court, which declared in part that academic freedom, quote, is of transcendent value to all of us and not merely to the teachers concerned. That freedom is a special concern of the First Amendment, which does not tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom, unquote. For those of us involved in the 1960s in teach-ins, this was a welcome piece of help. In New Jersey, for example, a Republican called for firing half of the Department of History that I belonged to following our famous 65 Vietnam teach-in. Our phone lines were jammed for months with death threats. That Republican, of course, became known as President Nixon. CUNY has a long history of doing this sort of thing. I was a student at City College when the professor of English was arrested outside a classroom. I was a student at Bronx Science when a biology teacher disappeared after the spring break. Brooklyn College students have experienced this, although they ended up being editors of the New York Times. The AAUP statement has been endorsed by 175 professional organizations, and the third largest university in the country, it seems to me, should be amongst them. Thank you.
Sandy Cooper, professor of history at the College of Staten Island, testifying last night. Also, Lanitha Lancaster, who is a student at City College, also spoke to the Board of Trustees of CUNY.
City College, an older student. I have a daughter that finished there a couple of years ago. So City is very, very special and dear to me. I left a school from down south where we have a six-generation history of being at a particular school, a Methodist college. I left it to come to City, where my daughter told me so many wonderful things about the college. So I'm here to just speak about the teach-ins, not to condemn or to slap anyone's hands for any statements, but to give you a little bit of my knowledge base about the teach-ins and the hurt that I feel. I'm speaking for myself, but I think I echo the sentiments of a lot of students at the school, the hurt we feel when we heard that some of the Board of Trustees came out and made statements without reviewing a tape of that hearing that is there and available to each one of you to see. The teach-ins were done with a lot of input, not just from the professors,
but the students as well. We helped coordinate this teach-in, and we wanted to be sure everyone, diverse opinions, could be heard. We were there. We know what was said. So the hurt, we know we can't fight the media, and that's not what we're trying to do. But what we would like to do is say to you, try and trust us before you answer statements or things that you heard. At least listen to the tape. Get a good idea of what's on the tape, and then make your statements to the press. When the statements were made to the press without viewing the tape, it just gave the New York Post a lot of credence, and it like slapped us and said, yes, you did this. What was said in that article in the Post is not what happened at that teach-in. So I want you to try and feel the hurt that most of us feel when we don't think that you give us at least a fair chance. The other thing is that the day before that article ran, there was another article in the Post as well that ran, and I'll read this. This is an article that the Cardinal came out and said, and I just want to read, I'll leave this because there's something else I want to read. You can read the caption of it where he says America should look inside, I'm paraphrasing, and decide whether or not they did something to the terrorists to make them have that type of hatred against America. The last thing I want to say is the teach-in that they're referring to was closed by President Gregory Williams of City College, wife, and this is what she said. I feel so grateful for the university because since September the 11th, I've been spending probably at least an hour every day with the New York Times trying to get information, and I feel so cheated and empty-handed. But I've heard so much today and this really terrific forum with substantive information, important information, thought-provoking information, whereas I've just felt I've been reading about this contest, which politicians is the most patriotic. But I just feel overwhelmed. So much truth has been spoken here today. I am very grateful. Thank you. This is the teach-in that the New York Post condemned. She ended this teach-in with those statements. Thank you.
And that was Lanitha Lancaster, a student at City College, one of the many who testified last night as the CUNY Board of Trustees decides whether to sanction professors who spoke out against war at a teach-in. You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Ellen Schrecker. She is a professor in New York, and she is author of No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the University. Stay with us.
I know the minds behind them, they are riddled full of holes. They are not to be trusted with their hands at the controls. Their eyesight is twisted with the glory of their careers. And the heaped praise of flattery is music to their ears. And to listen to them talk about how it hasn't happened yet, it's like playing Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Russian roulette. Who brought the deaths of millions, for it was their stock and trade. They are afflicted with the fallout that they themselves have made. They have sealed their own inevitable doom, and it shall surely come. And not even the moons of Jupiter will be far enough away to run when the world that they've assaulted begins to turn around and the unavoidable gravity pulls them to the ground.
Jim Page, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Russian Roulette, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The poet Wallace Stevens wrote that all history is modern history. Well, in recent weeks, we've seen a surge of attacks on academics and virtually everyone who is criticizing U.S. foreign policy, and a wave of efforts around the country to enforce one kind of patriotism. All of this has an uncomfortable ring for dissidents who lived through or have studied the period of U.S. history known as McCarthyism, which certainly encompassed far more than the brief career of Senator Joseph McCarthy. In the last weeks, Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld has said that we should think about this period not as a brief period, the war on terrorism, but he compared it to the Cold War and said we should think about it in that way. We are joined right now by a professor at Yeshiva University here in New York, Ellen Schrecker. Among her books, many are The Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. And the jacket of that book, No Ivory Tower, starts the story of the traumatic impact of McCarthyism on government employees and Hollywood screenwriters during the 50s is all too familiar. But what happened on college and university campuses during this period is barely known. And Ellen Schrecker recounts the previously untold story of how the anti-communist Führer affected the nation's college teachers, administrators, trustees, and students. The hundreds of professors who were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee and other government panels confronted the same dilemma most other witnesses face. They had to decide whether to cooperate with the committees and name names or to refuse such cooperation and risk losing their jobs. Ellen Schrecker joins us in the Firehouse studio now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. For many students, for example, those who testified yesterday, they weren't alive during the 1950s and don't really know what possibly we could be facing once again. Describe what happened to professors, administrators, students then.
During the 1950s, during the so-called McCarthy period from the late 1940s through the 50s, there was a real crackdown on dissent and on criticism of American foreign policy in the Cold War. Specifically, it was directed against communists, not denominated, not named as critics. You know, it wasn't as it is today against people who were criticizing American foreign policy, but against people who had once been in the Communist Party. And it's the same thing, though. It was the same attack on people who were not towing the line. And during the 1950s, we know of at least 100 college professors who lost their jobs. These were people sometimes who had tenure. Everybody who didn't have tenure was immediately dismissed or their contracts weren't renewed. What happened here was that under the stress of a quote-unquote national emergency, just like today, universities, administrations, boards of trustees gave in. They caved into public opinion. They caved into concern about the quote-unquote reputation of their universities. And although they gave lip service to the AAUP statement about academic freedom, the statement that Sandy Cooper read last night at the trustees meeting.
That's the American Association of University Professors.
Essentially gave in and redefined what a professor's obligation was. And as they redefined that obligation, it came to be seen as naming names before a congressional committee. Just as today, it seems very clear that under the pressure of public and aroused public opinion, people are in positions of authority are caving into the notion of what is American it is to support the Bush government and everything it does.
Last night, the historian Sandy Cooper talked with our producer, Chris Abrams, after the hearing about some specific examples of what happened to professors in the 1950s. We're going to take a listen for just a minute.
Here, because I believe academic freedom is one of the most crucial elements that keeps American universities afloat, and it has to be defended at all times and at all costs. And I'm very familiar with what happens when it's abridged. In the 1960s, we had teach-ins in which academics attacked foreign policy in Southeast Asia. I happened to be at the campus of Rutgers University when one of the earliest of those teach-ins occurred. It was not the first. The others had been at a couple of Ivy League schools, such as Princeton and Cornell. Rutgers was a state university. A number of members of the History Department of the Men's College, as it was then known, pointed out that the Americans were simply following a path of the French as colonialists in Southeast Asia, that the war in Vietnam had very little to do with communism, had a lot to do with national liberation. They went on to say that a victory of the Viet Cong would only be justice, because that's what had been promised in the earlier diplomatic accords. None of us knew anything about any of this. Certainly the students didn't. Within 24 hours, there was a firestorm. President, then not yet president, former Vice President Richard Nixon came into the state, demanded that the faculty be fired. There was an endless variety of calls that came to the History Department. When the secretary answered the phone, they thought she was on the faculty. They threatened her with death. It went on for months. We had a visiting professor from the South staying with us for the summer. He was threatened with death. It was simply unbelievable. The politicians, led by Nixon, whipped up this anti-academic furor. Anti-intellectualism appears in American life periodically. This was one time it certainly reared its head. It wasn't my first experience with the attempt to stifle free speech, because when I was in high school in the early 50s and a student at City College in the 50s, the McCarthy period was in full bloom. The biology teacher in my high school did not reappear after one Easter vacation. He had been mistakenly mixed up with somebody who had gotten into the country in the 30s, denying his membership in the Communist Party. They picked this poor chap up because he had the same last name. They stripped him of his seniority. They threw him out of teaching. It took years for him to clear his name. At City College, I've forgotten how many faculty were fired and how many were lost benefits and broke tenure. It was just gruesome. Many, many years later, we managed, some of us in CUNY, managed to get some pension money voted to be paid to the estates of their survivors, but they were stripped of everything. At Brooklyn College, the president threw the students out who edited a school newspaper that he disliked. One of those students ended up being the country's biggest civil liberties lawyer, and another one ended up being an editor of the New York Times. And in fact, last, I think it was June, at the graduation at Brooklyn College, all of those people were honored, and the current president had a dinner in their honor. So that we take 25 to 30 years to make up the pain we create when we do this sort of damage. I fully agree with the remarks made earlier today that when you distort the historical record for political and so-called patriotic purposes, you are in fact a greater traitor than those you accuse of treason.
And that is Professor Sandy Cooper, professor of history at the City University of New York. Our guest in the Firehouse studio is Ellen Schrecker, and she's a professor at Yeshiva University, author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. You just heard Professor Cooper going through some of the many examples. Now the Bush administration has set up a Homeland Security Administration headed by Tom Ridge, the governor, former governor of Pennsylvania, well known for signing 2 death warrants for Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as hundreds of others. Are you concerned about this administration?
Very concerned. It seems that every time there is a massive invasion of our First Amendment freedoms, it's being done in the name of national security. Certainly during the Cold War, which is the period I know best, every time that a college professor got fired, every time that a movie director or screenwriter lost his job in the blacklist, the rationalization was national security. We are in a time of crisis. Therefore, violations of people's free speech that in ordinary times we would never condone become necessary. And what we saw during the McCarthy period, and what brings many real concerns to my mind, is the fact that mainstream institutions like the Supreme Court, like newspapers, like Congress, all the way through, simply crumbled. The American Association of University Professors, that organization which was supposedly out there on the forefront of academic freedom, never censored any of the universities that fired people until after the crisis was over. Similarly, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, refused to intervene in most of the major violations of First Amendment free speech during the McCarthy period. So there are incredibly bad precedents out there for an entire society, even the guardians of that society, simply rolling over and letting these things happen, which, as Professor Sandy Cooper noted, then 35 years later, everybody says, oh my God, we can't ever let that happen again. Well, hey, fellas, it may be happening again.
What can people do to safeguard themselves, their communities, even if they completely disagree?
I think we have to really understand what free speech means. That if, you know, President Bush is saying we are fighting for our freedoms, we have to be very open about the fact that free speech is only free if it is free for the people whose speech you hate. This was something that is enshrined in many Supreme Court decisions, as well as ignored in many others. And we have to really stand up for our rights, even at a time when it's going to be very hard, and, you know, at a time at which you're going to get a lot of hate calls. For example, one person who comes to mind is Benno Schmidt. The man is a law school professor. He knows constitutional history. He knows what free speech entails. And the
he's
notion,
now chair of the Board of
he's
CUNY.
He's the chair of the Board of Trustees at CUNY. And it is incredibly hard for me to believe that somebody with that kind of a background would lend himself to any kind of sanctioning of professors who are simply speaking out on issues of public interest.
Well, maybe his former baseball commissioner, Benno Schmidt, is just too used to playing ball. And in this case, it will be with the administration. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ellen Schrecker, our guest, Yeshiva University professor, author of No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities, and Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. And that does it for our program. I'd encourage people to email us, let us know what's happening in your communities. We're also encouraging people to let us know about speeches that people are giving in your communities at teach-ins. We would like to run videotapes of them. Email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. And what's happening when it comes to freedom of speech at your university or in your church or synagogue or mosque, at public forums? These are the kinds of things that we are chronicling here. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and technical director. Earl Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! live. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA and Aaron Glantz, Free Speech Radio News producer. Thanks to all the folks at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno. To all the Pacifica affiliates who are running Democracy Now!, we are Pacifica. Special thanks to the Independent Media Center and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. We're also looking for Macintosh laptops and computers, and you can email us and let us know if you've got one you could give us at mail@democracynow.org. Thanks to WFMU running us every night, 91.1 FM at 7 p.m. in Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as Free Speech TV. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As nuclear rivals India and Pakistan break into gun battles and the U.S. sends a special forces gunship into Afghanistan on the ninth day of attacks, we'll hear from a man widely acknowledged as the founder of the discipline of peace studies, Johann Galtung. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting just blocks from where the first towers of the World Trade Center once stood, the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan now, the second. A U.S. Special Forces gunship went into action today, raking a Taliban stronghold in Afghanistan with heavy machine gun and cannon fire. U.S. jets returned to Kabul, blasting sites north of the city. First use of the low-flying, lumbering turboprop AC-130 over the Taliban headquarters of Kandahar followed the fiercest daylight raids of the offensive and marked a stepping up of attacks on Taliban leadership. It also signaled U.S. confidence that more than a week of attacks by ship-launched cruise missiles and high-flying jets have greatly eased the threat from Taliban air defense. We still don't know the number of casualties, civilian casualties, at this point. The compound of the International Committee of the Red Cross has been struck by a U.S. bomb that destroyed wheat and other humanitarian supplies, also injuring a guard. Three farmers in the Badambagh area of Kabul were injured when bombs fell nearby, this according to a neighborhood shopkeeper. And a spokesperson for the International Red Cross in Islamabad confirmed that two Red Cross warehouses were hit this morning. Here in New York, investigators are taking to media mailrooms across New York after learning that an ABC News producer's seven-month-old son was diagnosed with anthrax. Hours earlier, the scare moved into the halls of Congress when a letter sent to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle tested positive for anthrax. The diagnosis of the baby marks the second anthrax case at a major news organization in New York in 4 days, following one at NBC, in which a female employee was infected by a letter carrying anthrax. The little boy developed the skin form of anthrax after spending time at the ABC newsroom last month. He's taking antibiotics and is expected to recover. The NBC story continues to unfold. It turns out that the letter that was received just days ago by the NBC assistant to Tom Brokaw, which looked like a white powder and actually tested negative for anthrax, was not the envelope that contained the anthrax. That had been received on September 18th, a week before, not called to the attention of authorities, and it was a sand-like substance. There was no immediate word on whether anyone in Tom Daschle's office tested positive, but aides who may have been exposed to the letter are being tested with nasal swabs and are being treated with the antibiotic Cipro as a precaution. The letter to the South Dakota Democrat prompted a halt to all mail deliveries in the Capitol. At the Associated Press on Monday night, eight police officers, one wearing a bioprotective hazard suit complete with respirators, took spot swipes from the countertops and other surfaces in the mailroom looking for any anthrax residue. Other news organizations to be tested include CNN, CBS, Fox Daily News, and The New York Post. With Secretary of State General Colin Powell standing at his side, the Pakistani president said Pakistan will unconditionally continue to cooperate with U.S. military bombing of Afghanistan for as long as it takes for the operation to be successful. He says Pakistan will share intelligence with the United States, allow use of its airspace, and provide logistical support. President Musharraf also expressed hope that the operation in Afghanistan will be short, but Powell noted President Bush has said the anti-terrorist campaign in Afghanistan will continue as long as it takes to achieve its objectives. Bush has said that the campaign could be months, perhaps years. Powell said he's satisfied that his talks have provided a solid foundation for a durable U.S. relationship with Pakistan. Meanwhile, Indian troops fired mortar shells and rockets at Pakistani positions, saying it's to punish Pakistan for aiding Islamic militants in the dispute over Kashmir. Pakistan maintains India denies self-determination to the predominantly Muslim people of Indian-held Kashmir. We're joined now by Sputnik Colombi. She is a free speech radio news producer, and she is now in New Delhi. Before we go to the founder of Peace Studies, Sputnik Colombi, can you just give us a thumbnail profile of Kashmir and why it is the focus right now of this battle between India and Pakistan, how Afghanistan plays into that?
Well, Kashmir is a case of paradise that has become hell for most of the people who live there. The problem with Kashmir is that the Kashmir Valley is predominantly Muslim, but the state of Jammu and Kashmir, if you take the entire state and the province of Ladakh, which is also part of Kashmir, then you you end up having a majority Muslim population, but sizable percentages of Hindus and Buddhists. So I would say it's about 70% Muslim and 30% Buddhist. So this also complicates the agenda. Now, Kashmir was promised a plebiscite in 1947 when India became independent, that its people would be given the right to self-determination. It was at that time ruled by a Hindu king. And the Muslim leader of Kashmir at the time, who decided that his interest lay with India at the time rather than with Pakistan, was subsequently put in jail by the Indian authorities. And when he was released, by that time he didn't have as much popular support as he did in 1947. Following the 1986 elections, which were rigged, and in favor of a party backed by the then Congress government in New Delhi, Kashmir slowly but surely slid into anarchy. And that is the tragedy of Kashmir, because Kashmir is the cradle of the most secular kind of Islam, Sufi Islam. Kashmiris are noted to have been a very peaceful people, even though they've been invaded and ruled by foreign powers all through their history, and that now it's only the guns we're talking. Obviously, a lot of the support for the guns in the valley comes from Pakistan, from the notorious ISI, which is the Pakistan Intelligence Service. And that is the problem. Now people in Kashmir, the separatist groups in Kashmir, realize that if Musharraf can ditch the Taliban today after having backed them, after having brought them to power, tomorrow can be Kashmir's turns. And when Osama bin Laden tries to also jump onto the bandwagon and add the Kashmiri right to self-determination as amongst his many grievances and as amongst his many demands for justice and redressal, this puts the Kashmiri separatist leaders, the political establishment in Kashmir, in an uncomfortable position, because the line now between what is considered terrorism by one and what is considered a freedom struggle by the other has become very thin indeed.
Sputnik Colombi, thank you for joining us, Free Speech Radio News reporter in New Delhi, India. As we go now to Cat Stevens, actually, he converted to Muslim and is Yusuf Islam.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. I've been smiling lately.
Yusuf Islam, formerly known as Cat Stevens. Clear Channel Communications put out a list of more than 150 songs not to be played on its radio stations, among them Cat Stevens songs. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As they organize against the U.S.-British War of Afghanistan, peace activists in the United States are confronting the challenge of how to preserve civil liberties and security while working for peace and addressing the root causes of terrorism. Few people are more qualified to address these issues than Johan Galtung, and today we're going to spend the hour with him. He is widely known as the founder of the academic discipline of peace studies, served as professor of peace studies at universities of Hawaii and universities around the world. Johan Galtung established the International Peace Research Institute in Oslo in 1959. He's published over 1,000 articles and 100 books, and is a consultant to several UN agencies, as well as Transcend, a global network of 150 experts trained in conflict resolution who do field work around the globe. Johan Galtung is also a recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, commonly known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, and has helped mediate 45 major conflicts around the world. He spent this weekend at Pace University in New York for a day-long workshop on peace, conflict, transformation, and reconciliation. This is the speech that he gave, Johan Galtung.
I would like to start with a public opinion poll, which you may know, but it's also quite likely that you don't know it. It was made in 31 countries, and it was made about 10 days after September 11. It was a Gallup poll published in many countries, but I have never heard that it was published in the U.S. The people were given the choice between two options. And you may describe the options as police action and military action. The police action would have as its goal to apprehend the responsible, arraign them into court, and if possible, sentence them. And the military action would essentially be retribution, retaliation, but also possibly extermination. The overwhelming majority in the world, about 80%, were in favor of police action. There were only two countries in favor of military action. That was Israel with 77% and United States of America with 54%. The most belligerent country in that sense in Europe was France with 29%. England was way below that. Now, what this means is a little bit interesting. This is as close as you can come to a globalized democracy. We have nothing. The world opinion is not in favor of what is currently happening. They are in favor of apprehending the responsible and bringing them to justice in the way this is done in due process of law. They're not in favor of and all-out retribution. As I mentioned, that was only two countries. If the result of the public opinion poll had been the opposite, this would have been on the first page of all US newspapers and all Western newspapers. Now, there is something in that which is a little bit sad, and that is, of course, the first victim of war, which is truth. So I take that as a point of departure. Since I'm now going to, from a transcend point of view, design the policy, that policy is on two tracks, and track one is police action. Track two has as its point of departure this scheme. And it says we've had a major act of unpardonable violence, a crime against humanity, where we not only feel sympathy with the victims located so close to here, but also feel very strongly that there is something called justice and they should be brought to justice. But that doesn't mean that we stop thinking and that we stop asking ourselves, why did this happen? And along the line here, we have, of course, the idea of polarization and dehumanization, and the enormous amount of dehumanization underlying this act. And before that, the untransformed conflict. So the second track would then ask the question, which are these conflicts? What dialogues can we have? What possible solutions exist or transformations? What would be the first steps? And what would be the possible reconciliation that could bring us out of it? Now, that would be therapy. Before we try to engage in therapy, we usually do diagnosis and prognosis. But in this case, I will turn it around. I'll start with the therapy. So the recommendation are the following six steps. But it has as a point of departure the text left behind by the perpetrators, because they left behind a text. And the text was not written in English or in any other language. It was written in two buildings. And the message was that they had something against economic USA and military USA. They did not bomb the Statue of Liberty. It was not against Congress. It was not the White House. It was not Arlington Cemetery. It was not against any cultural monument of the US. It was against exactly economic America and military America. One can speculate about the fourth plane. If the fourth plane were heading for Langley, Virginia, it would complete the equation. I don't have the slightest basis for saying that that was the case, nor did Washington have any basis for saying that it was heading for the White House or even Air Force One, which even at their level of ability would have been somewhat difficult. So, the kind of moves that would have to be taken would have to address economic America and military America in terms of foreign policy. That, of course, requires that you buy into a model of this type, namely that violence is caused. And as we all know, discourse A today is not that discourse. Discourse A is the terrorist discourse. Namely, it is not caused by anything except to be evil. I think the president of the US used the word evildoer 9 times in his first speech. In other words, the point was made very clearly. The other side uses a similar figure, Great Satan. It's also a way of cutting out rational thought by just simply etiquetting the antagonist in a way which deprives the antagonist of motivation, rationales. We then have to address one problem. If we now say that they had reasons, does that mean that we justify what happened? No, it only means that we try to understand. We try to understand what those subjective reasons are. We may not agree with them, we may agree with them. But the point is that if we want this not to be repeated, we might contemplate the idea of removing the causes. So removing the causes of a heinous, violent act is one approach. The other approach is to define them as terrorists, as vermin to be exterminated. And that approach is today the approach that is being pursued. So let me now, after that brief introduction, take 6, maybe 7 policy steps. Step number 1 is US troops out of Arabia. And I on purpose do not say Saudi Arabia, I say Arabia. I think it has to be understood that to station US troops in a holy land with the two holy places is the moral equivalent of having the NATO headquarters in Napoli moved to the Vatican City. There are certain things one doesn't do. That it is an insult, and it does not help the slightest that that insult is accepted by the government. The government is not seen as an Islamic authority, the government in Arabia. Now, that insult can only be removed by removing the troops. Even worse is using military bases, air bases, for bombing another Muslim country. Continue along those lines, and the wounds will become even deeper, and the traumas even deeper, and it will continue. Remove the troops, and it will serve as a signal that the message has arrived. That's number 1. Number 2, lifting the sanctions in Iraq. And simply engage in a dialogue with the hated, also by very many Iraqis, regime. In 1991, they had four very concrete issues that all could be solved. It was when they encountered a total lack of willingness to listen to their issues that out of rage, the leader of the country, Saddam Hussein, made a fascist step in his invasion of Kuwait. I find that very often happening, that the major cause of violence is when one side comes to the conclusion that violence is the only language they understand.
Johan Galtung, founder of the Discipline of Peace Studies, speaking this weekend in New York. We'll come back to him in just a minute. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to Johan Galtung, winner of the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. The Right Livelihood Award has helped mediate 45 major conflicts around the world. He was speaking in New York this weekend.
And that was my purpose of the dialogue I tried to act with an Indonesian general. The 5 points he made, even if the language was harsh, the 5 points were entirely rational. We might consider, perhaps, East Timor independence, but you have to understand that we are apprehensive about the military, economic, cultural, social, and political implications. Now, the moment you pay attention to that, everything becomes different. So under the logic of one side being an evildoer, you're not going to listen, because why should anybody listen to an evildoer? He's only out to do evil anyhow. There's no reason to do it. The word terrorist is a communication that I have cut off my intellectual faculties. I'm not going to listen. I'm just going to act, and my basic canon of action will be search and destroy. So I am saying there is still an opening for dialogue with Iraq. Some of this has to do with the oil field shared with Kuwait and under the border, so that a country that is most intact can scoop up most of the oil. A division formula for that has not yet been designed. Point three, in connection with lifting the sanctions in Iraq, there is a statement by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, which is probably the statement I most often hear quoted in Muslim countries. As a response to a journalist interview in 1996 to the question, 500,000 children have been killed by the sanctions, they say. Is that really worth the price? He responded, it was a very hard choice, and yes, it was worth the price. Now, if you're willing to sacrifice 500,000 children for some political gain, it is known as fascism. An apology is due. That apology, since she is no longer Secretary of State, will have to come from higher forces. Point four. President Khatami of Iran some years ago issued an invitation for dialogue at the top level between Iran and Washington.
That invitation has never been taken up. This is not the question of negotiating some concrete settlement or concrete things today. It is a question of going through history from 1953, at least, when the U.S. toppled the Mossad regime, which was reasonably democratically elected, and put in place the Shah regime. Again, an apology is in order. But I think the basic point is the dialogue. When one has a dialogue, you will have to stomach that some things will be said that are not so agreeable. You may also have a couple of points to make. There may be an exchange, one big apology in one direction, a smaller one in the other direction. And you can discuss the size. But after that, you come to the next stage, namely, where do we go from now? But you have to tolerate that there is a first phase, a phase one. The strong will tolerate that. It's only the weak who escapes from it and cannot stomach it. Point five. When it comes to Afghanistan, I would, based on Transcend's experience with mediation in Afghanistan, suggest a five-point formula. Point one, a coalition government, broadly based, with Talibans, not without Talibans. 100% Talibans is unacceptable. 0% Taliban is also unacceptable. There are many percentage points between 0 and 100 that can be recommended. To be quite precise, there are 99 points. So there's much to choose from. Why not 0%? Because the Talibans have much to their credit in Afghanistan. The carriers of order. They have the abolition of the opium planting. They have the toppling of an even more hated regime, the Mujahideen, that are at the nucleus of the Northern Alliance. Now, that's already important. Religiously, they represent the same branch of Islam, the Wahhabite, as the Saudi, and in this case, Saudi Arabian regime. They are dogmatically the genuine children of Saudi Arabia. The treatment of women is the same, exactly the same. It's only that Saudi Arabia does it at a higher level of material living. Material living due to the oil. Now one country has oil, the other one can at most have an oil pipeline. The case for 0% Taliban is not what we heard, even from their very clearly declared enemies. The Taliban being indispensable, you then move on to point two. What's the purpose of such a coalition government? To satisfy the basic needs of the Afghan population. That means law and order for survival. It means adequate food supply, medicine, education material, and here the external world will have to help, and they accept help particularly from UN agencies, not from the Security Council for a reason I'm coming to, and from the organization of the Islamic Conference. There doesn't have to be any contradiction between those two. The third basic need is freedom, particularly the freedom of election and the freedom of the press. The Taliban is incapable to guarantee anything of that, as incapable as its mother regime in Saudi Arabia. The fourth basic need is identity. They're practically speaking all Muslims, but they talk very different tongues. The Pashtuns, the Hazara, the Tajiks, the Uzbek, the Farsi-speaking, could point to a federated Afghanistan. A federation instead of a unitary state. In this federation, the Northern Alliance has no place for three reasons. One is the very heavy load of Mujahideen. And I repeat, a more hated regime than the Taliban. The second reason is the preponderance of Uzbeks and Tajiks. In other words, minorities, and its weak representation among the Pashtuns, and other groups. And the third reason is the connotation of being an instrument of external powers. And that moves us to point three. Afghanistan's for the Afghanis. And that means a stop of meddling. Meddling from external powers. That started in 1842, has been going on all the time. It's called, cynically, by the powers that be, it's called the Great Game. The Afghanis are sick and tired and revolting against it. That doesn't mean that some of them cannot be bought. But I am deeply convinced that those will only be small minorities. And that the majority of the Afghani people want Afghanistan for Afghanistan. That brings us to point four. They want cooperation in the longer run with surrounding Islamic countries. But that will have to be on the basis of some kind of confederation, some kind of community, in other words, a Central Asian community. It would be Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and in other words, the five Central Asian former Soviet republics. It would mean Iran, Pakistan, part of Kashmir. This will take time. And that time is not yet ripe. That may take a long time. Point five and last point. They want to connect to the world, but do not accept the United Nations Security Council. For a very simple reason that very many people, unfortunately, are not reflected upon. The U.S. Security Council has an upper house of five veto powers. Four of these powers are Christian, one is Confucian, and sometimes confused. The four Christian powers are Protestant United States, Anglican England, Catholic France, and Orthodox Russia. It is worth asking the question how seriously we would take a Security Council with four Muslim countries and one Confucian country, sometimes confused. We would probably not take it very seriously. There are 56 members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference. They are all neglected by the Security Council. This is an untenable situation. Many of the Security Council mandated sanctions are against Muslim countries. There's not one against the Jewish state and few against declared Christian countries. Now, that doesn't mean that one wouldn't like to be linked to some kind of security arrangement. And the thought that I heard several times was an organization for security and cooperation for the Asia-Pacific. A regional organization like the OSCE for Europe. That would have Russia as a member, obviously. It would not have US and Canada as a member. They are members of OSCE. It is not quite obvious that Canada is a European country, nor the US. Those are things that can be revised. An organization for security and cooperation in the Americas obviously has Canada and the US as members. So having said that, I am reflecting the near consensus outcome of 1 week's mediation with 100 Afghanis. And I can, in a sense, challenge people to come up with a better expression. One thing they were particularly bitter about were mediators who only contacted top people. How about the king? How about Mohammed Shah? Not impossible. As a symbol to launch a loya jirga, the grand consultative round of sheikhs particularly. But not if he is seen as a US puppet. Since he is increasingly seen as a US puppet, it'll probably be problematic. So I have now said something about Arabia, 2 points about Iraq, 1 point about Iran, one about Afghanistan. Then come to point six, Palestine. We just pick up 1 point, the recognition of Palestine as a state, and this is where Washington has made a move. It's interesting, when I said exactly this list the same day as September 11, because I've been working on this for many years, so I know more or less where the sticky points are. And I gave this list. People told me it is totally unrealistic. It will never happen, particularly the point about Palestine. Well, that's exactly the point that happened. Don't ever say never. Things that will not happen today and not tomorrow may happen the day after tomorrow. You increase the likelihood by putting it on the list of witches. Now, I'll not elaborate on the Palestine, since that was what we did just before this. And there are many, 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 many more things to be said. I only want to welcome and hope for the sincerity behind the possible recognition of Palestine as a state. It will take some of the poison out of the relationship. The last point, globalization-free zones in the world. Pay attention to the fact that economic America was hit, the World Trade Center. In absolutely no way can the blame for all the ills of the world economically be laid at the feet of America. That's not the point. But the U.S. has a slightly unfortunate habit of referring to itself as the leader of the world. Now, if you do that very often, let us say, for instance, 50 times a day, it may happen that some people believe it, and you attract attention. It would be in the U.S. interest to disperse that leadership a little bit. It may be that others will say, no, for heaven's sake, keep it. You are the leader, you are the leader, you are the leader, for obvious reasons that I'll not elaborate. Globalization-free zones would be politically the same as the Kyoto Protocol, where the Third World is exempted from the strictures of the Kyoto Protocol. In other words, there is the idea that there are measures that have to be taken, but some parts of the world are more fitting for these measures than others. The reason why 100,000 people die per day cannot be covered by the term globalization, but it can be covered by the term monetarization. If you earn less than $1 per day, and that's the case for 1.7 billion people, you cannot buy land, you cannot buy seeds, you cannot buy water, you cannot buy artificial fertilizer, you cannot buy access to a hospital if all medical services have been privatized. And the combination of globalization and privatization means monetization. If you don't have it, you don't get it. So what do? You buy a bottle of Coke and one cigarette, you use those in order to soften the hunger pains, and you die. Now, if 100,000 persons do that, be not be surprised if some negative feelings arise at some points. That's every day. That's between 30 and 40 million per year. If each one of them leaves behind 10 persons who are bereaved, most of them illiterate, often apathetic, very poor. But don't be surprised if some of them develop slightly negative feelings. So these are six measures. They can all be done. They're all possible. And they would cost considerably less than $40 billion for warfare. Can I guarantee that they will solve the problem? I cannot, but I can guarantee that the other approach will not do it. So let us then go into diagnosis and prognosis, since I have indicated what I think would be a solution. The diagnosis then is that this is a chain of retaliation in a conflict that has lasted for very many years, but let me take 1945 as a point of departure. And the name of the conflict is class struggle. It is class between countries and between people? Class struggle. It is not clash of civilizations. If the U.S. had been engaged in clash of civilization against Islam, mosques would have been hit. The basic cultural sites of Islam would have been hit. Instead, what the U.S. consistently has done in Muslim countries has been to hit countries that have been a little bit progressive and progressive people within non-progressive countries. By progressive, I mean people who are working for distribution of the wealth and who are working for satisfaction of the basic needs at the bottom. One example of a slightly progressive regime, in spite of its dictatorship, was Iraq. One example of a very progressive group inside Iraq was Basra. It was Basra that was hit and not Baghdad. Basra is a major town in southern Iraq. Now, I see four stages, or if you will, four clusters in this class struggle. Cluster number one was in Asia, cluster number two in Latin America, cluster number three in the Muslim world, cluster number four, the Orthodox world. So let me try to take it. In the first cluster, the arenas were Korea, Vietnam, Iran, and Indonesia.
You're listening to Johan Galtung, the founder of the discipline of peace studies, speaking this weekend in New York, and we'll come back to the conclusion of his speech in just a minute.
Someday you wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind. Be where trouble melts like lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you find me. Oh, somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, and the dream that you dare to, oh why can't I? Them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Well, I see skies of blue and I see clouds of white.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report as we return to the conclusion of Johan Galtung's speech, the founder of the discipline of peace studies.
Key to the whole thing. So it says the following: our nation, the Islamic world, has been tasting humiliation and degradation for more than 80 years. Its sons are killed, its blood is shed, its sanctuaries are attacked, and no one hears and no one heeds. Now that was a self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe. More than 80 years brings us back to the period between 1915 and 1920. That means when the Arab nation was encouraged by the Allies, meaning England, France, and Italy, to rise against Ottoman rule, the Ottomans being the allies of Germany. They did, they succeeded, the Ottoman Empire was defeated, Germany was defeated, and the reward they got was English, French, and Italian colonization and the right of return for the Jews. Now, one cannot do such things. I, being fairly well at home in the Arab and Islamic world, I cannot travel any place and finding anybody, a school child, who doesn't know about this and the Sykes-Picot treason of 1916. The amazing thing is how few people in the West know it. And particularly amazing is the inability to take up this point. It should then be noticed that the 15th of November 1988, the Palestine National Council nevertheless declared a two-state solution as a possibility. In other words, conceding the right of an Israeli state. I concur. That's a very small thing. But they did not give any right to a British state, a French state, or an Italian state, but to a Jewish state. So let us then accept that as a fact of life. It's a part of the Middle East. I think the apology for the Sykes-Picot treason is still something that should happen. It's never too late. Now, it comes from two of the most arrogant countries in the world, England and France. I think more arrogant than the US, and that has to do with the following. England and France is ruled by aristocrats whose arrogance is very, very deep. At the top of the US, there are some people who have some doubts. That doubt is unknown in the French foreign ministry. It doesn't even appear in dreams. Now, having said that, one could quote much more from that speech. The load is heavy. So I repeat, this is class struggle. And I repeat again, it's not clash of civilizations. So how then do I define class? I have four dimensions of class. I define class as the relationship between the powerful and the powerless. Class and power are, to me, identical terms. There are four types of power. Political power, economic power, military power, and cultural power. Political power, who decides over whom? Military power, who kills whom? Economic power, who screws whom? Cultural power, who codes and encodes whom? There is no doubt that we are dealing with a one-way relationship here in all essentials. Nor do I think it is very difficult to imagine that there is a limit to how far one can go along those lines. My problem is not to explain September 11. My problem is to explain why it didn't happen before. And I can almost challenge anybody to try to explain it. You can say they tried, but it took some time to concoct that particular way of doing it. So, if you now assume 11 million killed and 500 million hating Washington, doesn't that mean that he who says it, namely I, am anti-American? No. I can, with a hand on heart, say exactly what so many people around the world say. I love America and I hate Washington's foreign policy. It's extremely, totally possible. It's not the slightest contradiction. I can detest Quisling and I can love my own country, Norway. I can dislike Hitler and Nazism without being anti-German. It's entirely possible. You need two cells in your brain to think that thought. If you have only one cell, it becomes too complicated. In that case, you will issue a certificate for anti-Americanism a little bit prematurely. So having said that, let us now go into prognosis. What will happen? Well, I have said there are essentially two discourses. There are two ways of conceiving of what happens. So one is to say they are simply evil, they are terrorists. They have no motive. They will continue killing and destroying regardless of what grievances are redressed. Moreover, if you redress a grievance, you are encouraging more terrorism. So let me now give, let us say, 5% credence to that statement. And let me give 90% to the one I believe in, a chain of retaliation within a class struggle. That leaves me with 5%, two alternatives. Some forces in the US brought it upon themselves. So there is the idea of a CIA plot against Pentagon out of old rivalries. I find it slightly cranky. But on the other hand, I was in the US when the Oklahoma federal building was bombed and remembered it very well. And all kinds of Washington experts came on TV and said it's typical Middle East terrorism. One ambassador came and said, I see the signature of Middle East terrorism in it. And the only approach is to find which country it is and bomb it, as usual, into the Stone Ages, which is the destination point. where Afghanistan has been for a long time, so there is no distance to go with that one. Now, it turned out to be the Midwest, not the Middle East, but the Midwest, from which part of United States Timothy McVeigh hailed. Yes, but he came before he did that. He came from the Midwest. And he's a New Yorker originally, so that means a very extensive bombing campaign inside the U.S. in order to teach them a lesson. Now, that has not been proposed and shouldn't be proposed, but it is a little bit important to think the thought just to see the insanity of the way of thinking. So having said that, there is one little point that should be made very explicit. The destructive power of the U.S. is, of course, much, much greater than the destructive power of something I would call the other side. So I just call it not U.S., but O.S., other side, since I don't know what it is. I would not underestimate the solidarity among these four clusters. And the Orthodox, by the way, is the war against Serbia, against the Orthodox part of Macedonia, and I'm afraid that the common target is Russia. Read Brzezinski, The Great Chess Game, about that one. Don't underestimate the solidarity, and that one group may feel they act on behalf of all four. Now, the U.S. destructive power is immense. The other side is much less. But the U.S. vulnerability is also immense, and the other side's vulnerability is much less. So if from the destructive power of the U.S. you subtract the vulnerability, maybe the equation runs the other way. And maybe what happened on September 11 was the dawning realization that the strongest is not necessarily the mightiest. That the sum total of the vulnerability could make for a chain of retaliation that could go on, for instance, 196 years. Now, 196 years would be the upper estimate. That is jihad number one against the Crusades. And George Bush mentioned the word crusade, which was very, very unwise. It was attempted, eliminated by going to a mosque the day after. It's not quite sure that that will efface the image left behind by a crusade bird. Now, the lower estimate would be 10 years, which is the duration of jihad number three. There have, as far as I understand, only been three great jihads. There have been many small jihads. Against the crusade, 196 years. Against Zionism, so far undecided. Against communism in Afghanistan, 10 years. The Muslims won number one and three. So let us then say that it will last between 10 years and 196 years, using history as a guide. Under what condition will that jihad be released? Under condition that it is perceived as a war against Islam. Under what condition will it be perceived as a war against Islam? Well, that is exactly the distinction between police action and military action. If this action had been mandated, not by the Security Council, but by the World Court, had consisted of 100,000 international soldiers who would simply have gone through Afghanistan from one corner to the other the way a police guard fans through a forest, hunting for the responsible, arraigning them into court, exposing them to due process of law, this would not be seen as a war against Islam. The way it is turning now, it is just at the border point. Add to that country bombing of Iraq, the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, some additional bombing in Libya and Sudan, and the measure is more than full. This is playing with extreme danger. In other words, the prognosis is not very positive. So let us then take the prognosis of the other course of action. My prognosis would be that if those six policies were enacted, a couple of hundred million Muslims would embrace the United States of America. There would be embraces all the way. Even in a sense for less than the kind of thing I said, but you see, it's not a question of parcels of food. It's a question of acknowledging that you have a point, we have got the message, we understand we have done something wrong, we are apologizing for something, we are moving some steps. Would that then come to the hardcore? Those who may be so deep frozen in their hatred that there is nothing the U.S. can do that would move them. I don't know. There might be such a residual hardcore. I'll not leave it out as a possibility, but I would think they would be very isolated. And I would think they would have their own turn against them. I do not think that that necessarily is the case today, which is one reason why Bin Laden has not been handed over. A little trimming of his beard, and he could hide among the 2 million in the immediate diaspora. If he extends the diaspora, he has 4 million, he could trim his beard a little bit further, maybe do something to the hair too, and he would probably be relatively difficult to recognize. He may have other strategies, considerably wiser than what I suggest. At any rate, I find it utterly stupid to add to the stupidity of the word terrorism the stupidity of pinning it on one person. It's an excessive Western individualism. The construction does not tell well about the IQ level of those who construct it, frankly speaking. It's an insult to talk to the world like that. So let's now get one step further, and I come to the end. The end is reconciliation. Reconciliation means stepping out of the chain of retaliation. And there is reconciliatory moves to be done on both sides. The major ones will have come from the US and the West that supported it. Some will have to come from the rest. Because the class structure is US, the West, and the rest.
Johann Galtung, founder of the discipline of peace studies, winner of the Right Livelihood Award, the alternative Nobel Peace Prize, speaking at Pace University in New York this past weekend. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland and Reem Katkhuda are at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at democracynow.org and webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA and Aaron Glantz at Free Speech Radio News. Special thanks to KPFA and affiliate station KFCF, to all our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to our Independent Media Center in New York and our hosts at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. We are on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34 and 56, and Channel 9415 of Dish Network, Free Speech TV channel. We're looking for Macintosh laptops and desktops. You can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Helicopters in the night, attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street morning, afternoon edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.